few City fans stressing overnight, stressing, fretting, after the club teased them with that major news announcement at 8 a.m. the next morning. We thought it was a comunicado official. Jamie McLaren departs for insert cashed up Asian or European club here, but he signed an additional 2-year extension with the club to keep him in City Blue until 2024. Josh Parrish and Pakua Frimpong in the studio today. Welcome, Pakua, again.
It's good to be back. Been a while since I've been here, so I'm good.
Listeners have heard your voice, though, even though you haven't been in studio.
Here we go. That's right. It's fine. It was weird hearing my voice in an ad. That was strange, I'm not going to lie.
The new star of FNR's commercial arm. At PFrimmy31 for all of your commercial voiceover
Please,
needs.
Go ahead, follow me. I appreciate it.
What do you make of this Jamie McLaren extension? Are City building a sort of Sydney FC-esque dynasty to dominate the A-League for years to come?
You have to win a title for it to be a dynasty first. That would be nice. But I think so. It's a good confidence builder, especially heading into the grand final on the weekend.
They've got Leckie in for next season, which we thought might push McLaren out the door from a salary cap perspective, or we thought might be an insurance policy in case he left. But in fact, he said that was the trigger for him to sign, the ambition that the club showed.
I believe that a little bit, but I also think there's a little bit of, I think there's some lies in that. I think he got some big offers, but they weren't the offers he wanted. So I think that City was a comfortable choice in the end, especially with Leckie going to be there next season. I think it suited him well.
This is good for City. Is it good for J-Mac? Should he be pushing himself a little bit more?
I don't think it's good for him. I think we see a lot of Australian players depart the A-League too early, but I think he might stay in the A-League a little bit too long and then might devalue himself.
Mm. I mean, some people like being a big fish in a small pond, I suppose.
Yeah, but he
guaranteed first-team football. He can play for the national team without going abroad.
But what I'm saying to you is, though, do you think he's going to have a better season next season than he did this season?
I think it'd be tough to top what he just did.
Exactly, because this City attack is so impressive that with Noonan and Boot, they clicked so well. If they don't click well with Leckie, are those same offers going to come next season for McLaren?
I think they probably will. I mean, everyone can use goals, right? Especially if he puts together some decent performances in a Socceroos jersey. But he's under contract for 3 years, so that means City control his destiny, and they won't let him go without a fight, without a big transfer fee. So I think he's just staying in the A-League. I think he, you know, there's a pandemic. It's not really enticing prospect to travel overseas and play. I think it's a little bit concerning that our best A-League players aren't being tempted by going overseas and are in fact are coming back. I think Leckie has come back too early. It's good for the A-League, but I'm not sure it's good for the national team when our golden generation, our most successful team, was based off European players testing themselves at the highest level.
I think that's your spot. You've hit the nail on the head, Dab. Like, you need players expanding, going to Europe and getting better, because there's only a level they're going to reach in the A-League. And if they go abroad and they get better and they learn better, the national team will, you know, succeed based off that. I don't know.
He had a few good months at Hibs, I remember, but aside from that, it hasn't really clicked for him in the national team or indeed outside of the A-League kind of bubble, you know, for Jamie McLaren. So maybe playing in the A-League, scoring 20 goals a season is the best way to guarantee his national team future.
To be fair, he is amazing, and it's going to be great seeing him in the A-League for the next, what, 3 seasons? So, you know, I'm happy as a spectator, but I think he could definitely have got somewhere that was bigger for him.
No Craig Noon next year. He's off to MacArthur. Do you think that's a loss? I mean, it is a loss, obviously.
It's a loss for MacArthur and Craig Noon. No, not MacArthur, sorry, City and Craig Noon.
I was thinking that's a bit harsh.
MacArthur definitely need... I know that MacArthur made the finals, and I understand that, but I find MacArthur such an unexciting team to watch, so Noon will make them more exciting, and that's all I can hope for.
Davila, Noon, De Silva, they're assembling quite a star cast for next season. They're hoovering up talent.
They paid a lot. They paid a lot this season, though. Mm. The football was
middling. Yeah, well, I guess they're going for proven performers this time around rather than imports where you're not sure.
They're trying to get some fans, so some exciting football would be nice to get some more fans, wouldn't it?
I think some cheaper tickets might be nice.
Ooh, That would be good.
They're paying literally nothing to rent Campbelltown Stadium. Surely, you know, their wage bill isn't so high that they have to charge fans through the nose for the privilege of standing in an active area that it's an obscured view anyway. I mean, the relationship with the active support has been kind of hilarious this season for MacArthur. They've firstly had a schism within the group, one side for the club and one side against the club, and then the side that was aligned with the club is now against the club as well.
How can you be in your first season and have fans already against you? Like Arsenal built it, you know? Arsenal spent 20 years building that. How in one season do you build fans not liking you? How does that happen?
the enmity.
Honestly, I just don't understand. Like,
it's like a rite of passage in the A-League, though, to have a supporter protest and a few people rip flares.
Yeah, but some people like to wait at least two seasons, not one.
So, MacArthur has gone through certain, like, phases of an A-League club, like, quicker than pretty much any other team.
MacArthur.
They've had the sort of overseas overhyped imports that didn't quite live up to the billing. They've had an ex-Socceroo who's completely washed up and ended his career here. Yep. Shout out to Mark Milligan, but he was pretty washed this year, and I think that's why he's retiring.
Yeah.
And now they've had the stealing talent from other clubs, which has been the Melbourne Victory approach. Most of Victory's best years have come from stealing players off Brisbane Roar. So.
MacArthur remind me of like an old man, like, you know, just a bit slow, just a bit drab. You know, they have some good moments where you have some like good, funny, you know, little quips, but and then they get in these. I just MacArthur just so nothing to me when I watch them in the A-League, and I'm like, can't you do something more that's like that's worthwhile turning the TV on to watch?
Yeah, it's not gone quite to plan, but I think they're trying to make moves in that direction. The problem is, we talked about early in the season, they're so overcoached. But why are we talking about MacArthur? It's grand final week.
Exactly. Jeez. We want to talk about teams that are in the finals.
And we also want to talk about the Dolan Warren Awards night, which is coming up. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a bit of a miscommunication, we thought, on the A-League socials, putting up this graphic saying, these are your nominees for the Johnny Warren Medal. People won't have the A-League social media team just done this of their own accord. Is it three contenders? Are these the only three people in line to win it? But apparently, the top three in voting are Ulises Davila, Alessandro Diamanti, and Milos Ninkovic. No McLaren in sight.
Can you explain again who does this voting process? Because I need to know who I should blame for this. Because it doesn't make any sense.
Well, at least a quarter of the blame can go to the match officials, which is the same way they do the Brownlow. It's pretty standard, 3-2-1s. I think it exposes a flaw in the 3-2-1 voting system because it's on a game-by-game basis, a player of the match performance. If you're in a good team with lots of good players who are all contributing, they actually take votes off each other. So being an outstanding player in a very middling team or a bad team, as Alessandro Diamanti was this season, gives you a better chance of garnering votes.
But even in that, I think it's flawed because as spectacular as like he is as a player, I don't think he's had that great of a season. Like he's spent a large portion of the season injured and then some of the other games he started on the bench. So I just don't understand how he's stacked that highly and, you know, ended up, what is he, I don't know what the ranking is now, but how has he ended up in the top three? It doesn't make any sense to me.
So this is the voting panel. There's four people on the body that's appointed by Football Australia. One technical football expert from a sub-panel of technical football experts appointed by Football Australia. So I guess they have a rotating cast of people who vote on different matches. One football media representative on a rotating basis. One former professional player and the match officials for each game. So it's a decent
range.
I guess the technical expert's probably like a coach or technical director or something like that.
I'd like it to be like the NBA voting for, and we get to see what everybody voted for because that would be really nice and add a bit of flair. You know, I love a bit of drama. You know, it'd be nice.
Do you think it should be a end of the season? Someone picks it as opposed to a match by match.
Yeah,
3-2-1.
Because I think you've got to look at the whole body of work. Like, I agree with you. The 3-2-1. There's a lot of flaws with it. But if you have a look at somebody's body of work and their impact, you know, and how far the season they've progressed out of the season, I think that's a more justified than the 3-2-1 system.
I think Davila is a fair nominee. Yeah. He's probably first or second with McLaren 100%. This season. But McLaren's also had a lot of help, in fairness, at City. You know, Nabut's been great when he's been on the pitch. Kolakowski, Tilio, Noon.
But then one of those, at least one City player should have made this final three. Like, yeah, I get that he's had a lot of help, but he's also put the ball in the back of the net, and you have, and somebody has
25
to.
25 times.
Exactly. And he's done it at an incredible rate, and not just like logging a lot of goals in one game. He's spread them out fairly evenly. So how he hasn't ended up in the final three is something that the A-League needs to question their voting system.
Keep your comments coming through on the Twitch. Sardine, our resident MacArthur fan, pointing out that it's technically true they pay nothing for the stadium rent, but they pay a huge amount for security, catering, etc. Well, everybody pays that.
If you've got to have fans to need security, so I don't... It doesn't really make sense to me, does it, Sardine? Like, come on.
Maybe they wouldn't need as much security if the fans were getting on better with the club in the active area, maybe. And he says, season one, we recruited players to play a style. Season two, we're recruiting players who can play the style in a certain way to plug the holes where the style failed. So this seems like a long way to make excuses for the coach to me.
Exactly. It seems like a lot of spending and not a lot of success.
Well, you know, I think they're wanting to stamp their authority. First club, new league, new club, new team. Players who don't know each other, finishing sixth. If you probably take that at the start of the year,
but
you just don't like watching them.
I honestly just don't like watching them.
They're not bad.
They're not. They are an okay football team, better than a lot of football teams, but doesn't mean I want. It's like I don't want to watch Jose Mourinho's teams all the time unless they're in the finals. I don't choose to turn my TV on to watch that.
It's fair. Yeah. So grand final coming up this Sunday. It's going to be 50% capacity, so 15,000 people allowed at Amy Park.
No Sydney fans?
Not if they're in the hotspots.
Yeah.
Sydney moved several players out of those spots in line for the midnight deadline so they could get across the border in time.
Yep.
Seems a little bit of a hurried production we're putting on here. I really think just waiting a week and getting the Socceroos back would be...
And I think it would be Sydney versus Melbourne have been the best two teams the whole season, the most consistent teams, and we deserve a final that is worthy of that. And I think that the City team are quite depleted from their best team, and Sydney, like, this week hasn't been the greatest preparation. So I think we're going to be in for an entertaining final, but not the final we deserve as A-League fans.
Yeah, I think it's going to be good, but as you say, without the star attractions, City will have to rely on Kolakowski and Tilio, who may not be as good at this point in his career as the first-choice players, but I think they're arguably more entertaining.
Oh, definitely. They, just like any players who are young, they have moments of brilliance, and then sometimes I'm watching them, I'm going, wait, what have you done again? Why have you got to this position? But they are fun, and City have got good players from the bench who can step up, and that's all you can ask for players on the bench.
Well, have you got a tip for us? Grand final, Sydney FC, Melbourne City.
I've been to a lot of City games this year, but I think that City can't play when the game is slowed down. I think that's what Sydney are going to do. So I think it's going to be a 2-1 victory to Sydney, but I really would like City to win.
I'm going to say City are going to do it.
Do you?
Home turf. Home fans. Sydney have not been as solid at the back this season as they have in the past. Ninkovic's performance is crucial, and you know he didn't play in the semi-final, so maybe they were resting him for this game. He sets the tempo for them, even if he's not contributing goals and assists necessarily. The interesting thing is, do they start Baumjahan after he starred in their semi-final? Do you drop Barbaroussis maybe? Because he's been misfiring this season. He hasn't hit the target. He hasn't really justified the exorbitant salary that we keep being reminded of.
He is the greatest sidekick the A-League has ever seen. Fantastic.
He's a Robin.
Honestly, he's phenomenal. This season hasn't been great, but his A-League career, if I was him, I'd be, you know what? I'm a second. I don't need to be the best. I pop up when I want to pop up, and I get paid a lot of money. I don't see anything wrong with that at all.
But do they start him is the question.
No.
No?
No.
Don't need his pace to stretch the defence with old men Adam Lafondra and Bobo up front?
With 15 minutes left, they're down. It's like 0-0. Then bring him on. He'll be, you know, experienced player, and he might be the hero.
I reckon they do start him. They leave Bobo on the bench as the impact sub.
That's big. That's a bit cool.
Yeah, but, you know, he's not getting any younger. He played 90 minutes or thereabouts in the semi-final, I believe. So
I think
it might be better to...
Costa's got to stay on the bench.
Yeah?
He can sit down.
Interesting.
They can chat about it on their bus trip, on their plane trip down.
Tanasi says, Kolar and Tilio have injected City with the identity they've been craving since day one.
But actually, speaking of the final, I actually don't think it's going to be more... I think it's going to be down to Cosnoburi. If Cosnoburi can tactically come up with a plan that can break down the Sydney team, because they've struggled to do that. They drew the second time they versed this season? Or mm-hmm.
I can't remember, to be honest.
But yeah, I think if Cosnoburi can come up with a plan that is sound and can give them the tools to win, I think then City win. But if not, then they're done.
The main game I remember between these two was the home match where Sydney were trailing 3-0. City blitzed them, and then Ninkovic came on and it was 3-2.
Yeah.
So that's why I say his performance is pretty crucial in this fixture.
I just think that their second matchup was more realistic of what both teams were. But to be fair, there's no McLaren and there's no, like, the front three that everybody's feared this season. So, you know, you never know.
You're right. That was a 1-1 draw away from home. So winning a draw, that's a pretty good record against Sydney. Yeah. Then again, no McLaren.
Exactly.
Looking like no Naboot either.
And no
Metcalf.
Yeah. It's going to... If City win, I think it will be... Show a lot of character and a lot of growth. And they've put in a lot of work this season. I think they have clearly been the best team all season.
That's why I'm backing the young boys in. Tilio, man. He's A-League's newest star.
He's a star, definitely. But Sydney have got this sorted, I think.
World Cup bolter.
It's all
right. Bit early for that, maybe. Yeah,
maybe
all right.
A little bit.
Before we go to a break and we talk about something other than Australian football, don't suppose our Oakley media manager over here got caught last night's game, did you?
Oh, of course I did. Come on. Come on, the Cannons. We're the best. We're winning.
Yeah, congratulations on beating a Preston team who made 7 changes to their first team.
Hey, a win is a win. That's all I see. I only see that 1-0 victory. I see success, okay? Come on. Easy win for us.
Chris Davies is their top scorer. He's a striker. He played centre back.
Hey.
He was playing central defence.
Hey, we all had to face the same issues. We had injuries also.
And Joe Guest watching on from his South Bank apartment, trying to get a clear view of the pitch.
Genius. He was telling us where players were to go. That's why we won.
For the uninitiated, Joe Guest, Oakley's star player, reigning FV gold medalist from back in 2019, he was fortunately caught up in one of the hotspots, had to quarantine for 14 days and missed the game, but it wasn't too far away from the ground. So I do wonder whether
he had binoculars looking, you know.
I mean, the game was streamed, so it would be a little inconvenient if he was trying to do it the old-fashioned way. But,
exactly.
You know. And Preston... I think a lot of people were asking me, like, why on earth they rotated all these players. They didn't take the game seriously.
I'm actually a little bit curious about that myself. Yeah.
I think first and foremost, the league's the priority.
Yeah. Where are they at the moment?
They're in NPL 3. They're top of the table. And they probably have a chance to extend their lead at the moment because all the top sides below them are playing each other, Doveton, all the A-League youth teams. But they want to do this before A-League youth teams start dropping down their players involved with the senior team again. So it's the perfect time for them to try and press home the advantage and really basically bank promotion. They want to be involved in the National Second Division, but nobody takes them – well, people do take them seriously, actually, because they're getting 3,000, 4,000 people to games when they're allowed to have crowds.
They're a big club. But nobody can deny that.
Biggest club in Victoria, man.
Hey, the Cannons. Great Cannons.
But they lose a little bit of credibility if they're playing in the third tier of Victorian football. So the league campaign is the priority. They want to get promoted this season, potentially get promoted again next season, which is going to be a bigger jump from NPL 2.
I believe you said something last night about, you know, Preston, like the board and stuff. They don't want to be seeing them versus Oakley in the FA Cup. They want to see them playing him in the NPL. I caught that last night, Josh. Good commentary last night.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And big shout-outs to Teo Pellets there as well. Excellent as usual. His golden vocal cords. But, you know, it was a pretty spirited display from a rotated side. Just imagine if they played the first team, Oakley be in trouble. Watch out.
Oh, come on. Cannons all the way. We would even if they played their first team, we'd have bet 3-0. We're being generous.
Yet another gear, you reckon?
Absolutely. Elevation. We're better.
Never a penalty, by the way.
Oh, come on.
Never a penalty.
100% a penalty, guys.
We'll go to a break. Euros chat on the other side. It's Twilight Football here on FNR. Twilight Football here on FNR Football Nation Radio. Josh Parrish and Pecua Frimpong on the airwaves. And we're going to talk about the Euros in a little bit. But before we do that, Pecua, we're going to do something we haven't done in a while and go into a bit of Club Corner. Ooh. Because we love going local. We talk a lot of NPL on this show. Sometimes we don't go far enough down the pyramid to talk about where the football is really happening, which is the grassroots level, the clubs that keep this sport going. The enthusiasm for football starts at the grassroots, the participation numbers. That's where the game is, and that's where we would be lost without it. So we've got Dana Durkic, the president of the Fitzroy City Soccer Club, on the line, a club which is flourishing despite the challenges of the pandemic and has a proud history as well. Welcome, Dana.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the club and where Fitzroy City have come from.
Sure. Our club is in its 58th year of existence. So we were established back in 1963 by migrants that came out from Serbia. And they scraped together a small sum of money of $3,000 to get themselves actually registered with the federation and become an actual team rather than playing just amongst themselves in local parkland and so forth. So they registered a team known as Carlton United, and they used to sort of play out at Royal Park, and from Royal Park they sort of played around the inner cities of, you know, Como Park, around South Yarra Paran, that type of thing. And then in the early 80s, they moved out to Ringwood, and they played at Ringwood Quarry Reserve for a number of years, and moved to Fitzroy, which was out on, at I think it was called Brunswick Oval, Brunswick Street, and spent a number of seasons there, and then Fairfield Park. And back in 2019, an opportunity presented itself, and we as a club were sort of bursting at the seams. And we had, I think pre-COVID, the year before pre-COVID, I think it was something like 230 registered players, and Fairfield Park was just getting a little bit tight for us, and an opportunity presented itself to express an interest at Kevin Bartlett Reserve. And and we spent probably about an 18-month period doing what we had to do to better ourselves and get ourselves over at Kevin Bartlett Reserve. And now we're based in Burnley/Richmond.
Yeah, Kevin Bartlett Reserve has had a few different clubs play at it in the past few years. What's the state of the facilities and so forth like there now?
It's top notch facilities. You're basically playing on a premium prestige ground, and we've got facilities that cater pretty much for hundreds of crowds. We've got, and for those who come hungry and thirsty, we've got a kitchen that offers the best chavapi rolls that money can buy in Melbourne, and we've got an open bar as well. So we offer that for our supporters and spectators. But our facilities are next to none. We also have what we call our little VIP section, and so we've got. You can go upstairs and you have an aerial view of the ground. So the facilities are next to none.
So the senior men's team is playing in State League One Northwest, is that correct?
Correct. We were in 2019, we were promoted from State Two.
Right.
And 2020, we were supposed to play in State One, but that never happened. And, but yeah, 2021, here we are, playing in a division that's definitely a tough one. Definitely a tough one.
Well, I can attest to that. I, through covering the Preston Lions in 2019, I went to watch a number of games in that very division, and there are a few more competitive, more physical, more high stakes kind of leagues, than State League One Northwest, where everybody is scrapping and clawing to try and get promoted into the NPL structure. It's no holds barred kind of football.
That's definitely right. And not being promoted in 2019 and not having any game time in 2020 really proved it quite difficult to go into 2021 in that senior level. It's only one league up, but it feels like it was just a different ball game altogether. Just the quality of the game that's out there. So yeah, we definitely went through a few turbulent weeks of just trying to get ourselves right. And I think we're in that stage where we'll settle down and get some getting some points on the scoreboard. So it's looking good for us.
As a club president during COVID last year, what did you have to do to make sure to keep the club running still and keeping all the fans of the club, you know, still active with it?
Yeah, great question. One of the things that we didn't really have up to scratch was our social media. So in 2020, we engaged a social media person. So a shout out to Vanessa, who operates a business called Art Junk Media, and she really lifted our social media status into the 21st century. And so we spent a lot of time doing a lot of social media, so trying to interact with our supporters, giving our social media a facelift, interacting with our supporters, quizzes, highlights, did you know this happened on such and such a day, asking for our supporters and especially the little kids to send in like videos and tips and tricks and things like that. So that they're the sort of things that we try to engage in while we're in COVID. Additionally, another big thing that was quite successful, and again trying to engage with our supporters and our member base, was merchandising. So that was a very big hit with our merchandising in 2020. It was one way of keeping engaged with our supporters and our members.
Now, Dana, one of the things we were really privileged to do over the past year or so was our work with Western United, and we managed to go over and film an interview with the great Kane Shepherd at Caroline Springs George Cross in the club rooms there where they train, and he's actually got a foundation which I understand Fitzroy City is involved with.
Yeah, definitely. So Kane reached out to us late last year and said, you know, I run a foundation, KS Foundation. It's for autistic kids. And he introduced an inaugural program, which we'll privy to be the first club. And so it was kids with autism and allowing them to play soccer in a safe environment that they were comfortable with. And I'm a mother of two boys. And my kids have been involved in soccer since they were 7 and 8 years old, and they're well and truly in their adulthood now. But watching those kids, and I think we had something like a 6 or 8 week program towards the end of 2020, and it was easily one of the highlights of my soccer life to watch these kids firstly arrive on day one and where they were 8 weeks later. In how much they enjoyed the program and the smiles on their faces, and it was just one of the best things to be involved in. And we still have the program running. It's not on Saturday mornings anymore. We're running it on Thursday afternoons at Kevin Bartlett Reserve, and it's something that we're very, very proud of and would love to grow and get the awareness out there, and the kids don't have to be of any skill level or any sports-based background. It's just come along, enjoy, and have fun.
Is that something that you think that separates your club from other clubs with how inclusive you are and how inclusive you've become?
Yeah, I believe so. It's definitely something that I've never been aware of again, just referring back to, you know, as a soccer parent, and definitely as a president or a committee member of any sporting organisation that I've been involved with. So this is something that we have to be aware of, because it is out there, and we have to open our arms and embrace everybody who wants to participate in sports.
We're speaking to Dana Dirkic, the president of the Fitzroy City Soccer Club here on FNR. Dana, that's just fantastic. It's great to see the club being so proactive and so inclusive in that space. But the senior men's team taking on Caroline Springs George Cross at home this Saturday, that's a pretty tough game against a very big and very ambitious opponent.
It is a very, very tough game, but we lost to them 3-1 in the first round, so we played that away, obviously, and now we're welcoming them to our ground, so it's going to be on our turf under our conditions, and I believe the boys will give it their all, and it definitely won't be a easy game for Caroline Spearings, that's for sure.
Well, have you had any communication as to whether you'll be allowed fans? We're all eagerly anticipating that that announcement.
100%. We're definitely allowed fans. Crowds are allowed. So I am inviting everybody and anybody who's interested in the game of football to come down to Kevett Bartlett Reserve. We have our reserves kick off at 5 p.m. This Saturday, and our seniors kick off at 7 p.m. So all of our supporter base is most welcome, our members, our and our sponsors as well. So definitely come on down.
Well, Donna, I think I can already smell the wafts of Chivapi smoke from over here. So we wish you the best of luck. Make sure all your supporters get down in numbers, and taking on former National League giants in George Cross. It's going to be a fantastic game, and stay in touch.
Thank you, I will. Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you to David Krunic for reaching out and inviting us to come on board and have a chat and promote our club.
Our pleasure, Dana. Take care.
Thank you, Josh.
That was Dana Dirkic, the president of the Fitzroy City Soccer Club here on FNR. Good to reach out to clubland, see where the temperature's at. It's interesting to hear about the lockdown and how it actually forced some clubs like Fitzroy City to innovate in the social media space.
Hey, as a media manager of a football club, social media is very important, and us social media people, we care, and we want our clubs to do well.
So that's a bit of vindication for
exactly
for your lot on the Twitter sphere. And
pat myself on the back.
Absolutely. We'll take a quick break. On the other side, Euros chat. Croatia turning on the afterburners against Scotland, and England just squeaking by, perhaps thanks to your boy Bukayo Saka. That's coming up after a quick break.
DJ Josh?
I think this is DJ Ed, actually, stealing his playlist. I'm always surprised. I always put something on from the Ed Gooden back from breaks
it's a bit
playlist.
Different. It's different,
it's a bit,
but it's
a bit
nice.
Of a chill vibe.
Yeah, it was good. I like it.
Yeah, it's the kind of soothing feeling that I felt watching England in the second half and slowly drifting off to sleep.
In the second half?
Yeah, goodness me. What,
near the end of the first half.
0.00 XG for England in that half.
You do love
football.
Your XGs,
that. I do, but, you know.
It's a good start.
Arguably not very useful over a small sample size, but no, we won't talk
about
that.
All right.
Actually, no, I wasn't falling asleep because I was second screening that game. TV was on Croatia-Scotland.
Literally the same. I had my phone there and I was like, I'm going to watch the Croatia game. And then the England game. If it wasn't for Bukayo Saka, I would have turned that game off way earlier.
Just love your Arsenal, don't
you?
Of course. You can't get enough.
Because I just feel this is, as an Arsenal fan, this is the moment I've been wanting other fans to see, that this kid is better than Mason Greenwood. He's better than Phil Foden, okay? Bukayo Saka is the future of England right there.
I will say this. He can defend better than any of those guys.
Mm-hmm. He can play. He's so versatile.
He's played left back.
Exactly. And he's one man of the match playing left back for England. And I think it's such an underrated quality that he will go into any position and be willing to play them, and play them well is a good thing.
You know what's a benefit of having him in the team is he makes up for the fact that Jack Grealish doesn't want to do any defending.
Hey, if Jack Grealish, they're going to be an Arsenal duo, okay? Next season, this season, we don't know, but it will happen, okay?
I think he's going to City, mate.
I don't know. He's an Arsenal kid, okay? I'm telling you.
I think he's a Villa boy, isn't he? He's a villain.
It's all right. Bukayo Saka is getting him onto the Arsenal team. I'm telling you, they're like best friends on Instagram every time I look.
Jack Grealish is so beloved by England fans, particularly match-going England fans. I think it's because he doesn't play for one of the big six clubs.
Yeah.
And a lot of the match-going England fans don't support the big teams. They all go for, like, Grimsby and stuff.
And he just seems like a nice guy who doesn't seem above it all.
Mm.
And his rise has been, like, a nice gradual rise, and it's not blatant in your face.
Yeah, and he also, I think, embodies, they see themselves in him. Yeah. Like the ultra-professional, clean-cut kind of private schoolboy image of Mason Mount doesn't really resonate.
No.
I mean, you know, nice guy and everything, but doesn't really resonate with the kind of working-class English football
and
public.
He's a hard worker on the field as well. Like, not like defensively, but he'll do those little runs in between, and he'll make those passes, and he'll do the extra little bit going forward, and that's a pretty.
He's a charismatic player to watch. Like, you get excited, you sit up a little bit when he's on the ball.
Exactly.
He's always dangerous. He takes a lot of touches. He takes a lot of time on the ball, but he's pretty effective. And I think it's taken Gareth Southgate a long time to actually trust him in an England jersey.
It's taken Gareth Southgate a long time to do a lot of things. It's Gareth Southgate. What can you say?
Honestly, I like this lineup for England. I mean, it really tapered off in the second half when they brought Jordan Henderson on.
Yeah,
but
the problem with it is that he should have figured out his best lineup before he came to this tournament.
Mm.
And that it's that
he still doesn't know what his best lineup
and
is.
And you know what the problem is? That Raheem Sterling has scored their only two goals of the tournament. I understand that, but I can't justify Raheem Sterling starting in their 11 over Jadon Sancho. I just can't.
Not on paper, no.
No, because he's good, and I just don't think they've got the right combination going forward, and they have so much attacking threat that it doesn't make sense.
You can't really drop Sterling now, though. He's the only one who scored goals.
And that's the problem. It's like Gareth Southgate may have not had the England job had he not made, you know, a semi-final of a World Cup.
Mm.
But he still has it now, and that's the same situation they are with Raheem Sterling. So, you know.
I think we're past the point where Jadon Sancho is going to have any significant involvement in this tournament. So that I can stop banging that drum because there's no point. I mean, viewers of the Bundesliga are pretty puzzled by the fact that he's been totally frozen out, even though he's one of the most successful chance creators in European football. And this is a team that can't really score too many goals.
Even as an Arsenal fan, I love Bukayo Saka. I was speaking to my friend yesterday and I was saying, I'm okay with him not playing at this tournament because I understand it, but it baffles me how he made it into the starting 11 ahead of Jadon Sancho. I need to understand the dynamic between him and Gareth Southgate because I think there's more to it than just like, I think it's just because he doesn't play in England really is what it looks like.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's been a problem for a lot of players. I mean, Kieran Trippier is not getting the starts or the respect. I mean, he should be starting at right back ahead of Walker.
They just won La Liga, so doesn't make any sense.
And he's a set piece specialist as well. I mean, why are you playing him at left back? Why? There's a lot of competition for places at right back. I understand that. But Kieran Trippier, for me, offers so much in terms of both offensive, defensive, club form, set pieces. He's got everything.
There's just a lot of simple questions that keep getting asked towards the England team. That don't make sense. Like, if I'm asking, like, you know, some massive tactical questions, that's okay. But, like, these little things of, like, everybody can see and Gareth Southgate seems to be missing them because this team is not playing football that's going to win them this tournament. I don't even see them making the quarters, if I'm complete. I don't even know if they will make it past the round, like, the next round, to be honest.
You know what I think is the best piece of a very simplistic but very effective analysis that I've seen? Is Wayne Rooney's The Telegraph that he writes. He does a column. And I don't know if someone's ghostwriting it for him.
I think they might be.
But he's really perceptive. And you know what he said about Jack Grealish? He said that these players in the top six clubs, particularly like Manchester City and lesser extent United, but Chelsea under Tuchel, they're very automated in what they do.
Oh, I'm 100%.
They've got really specific game plans that are drilled and drilled and drilled, and there are lots of players around the ball to combine with. In England jersey, and in international football, it's much harder to prepare a team to play in that coordinated way. So a lot of the time, it just boils down to 11 v 11, one-on-one matchups. Can you beat a player? And that's why Phil Foden is so good for Manchester City, but kind of meh for England.
Yeah. No, I actually 100% agree with that analysis, because the way these, like, Man City are fun, but after a while when you watch them, it's just a bit very repetitive. And this England team, it's like they want to have this structure, and these players are so stuck on this, like, the structure that they, like, have got in their heads that they just can't be creative. And that's why I think Bukayo Saka works really well, because he can adapt to any, like, an Arsenal or rubbish, so he's got to adapt all the time anyway, so he's used to it.
He's a very smart player with his movement. I mean, Sterling is too, to be fair. He makes a lot of good runs in behind. He complements Harry Kane reasonably well. That's why he scored a couple of goals, because he gets on the end of things. Yeah. You know, he's not doing as much on the ball as, say, a Grealish. But that's why I think Grealish fits really well, is because he can sort of improvise and freelance. He doesn't need specific tactical instructions to go out and do his thing. He's going to beat a player and create a chance regardless of what the manager tells him to do. And that probably makes it a less comfortable arrangement for someone like Southgate, who's a little bit of a control freak.
Oh, absolutely.
But he doesn't have the time to prepare a team where being a control freak will actually be beneficial. I think he's better off giving a couple of players license to be creative and, you know, just keeping the solid structure. Because, honestly, I've been critical of the two holding midfielders. It is stolid. It is boring. But recently, the evidence suggests that you do not win tournaments by playing attractive football. You win it by being solid defensively. And they haven't conceded a goal yet. So if Southgate gets bullied out of playing the two holding midfielders right when they start playing good teams where they actually need it, I think that could actually spell disaster for England.
But I like that they haven't conceded any goals, and that's nice. But my actual question to you is, their biggest problem to me is Harry Kane still playing a full 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Because he's not even daring to try something different. For the Czech game this morning, they knew they were through. So he, in the last, you know, 15 minutes of that game, you can try something different and take Kane off and bring on another, you know, attacking player and see what you can do. Because if, let's say, Kane gets injured and you haven't played with any of these players going, like, in a big match, you're essentially you're done for.
Southgate's going to go down with the good ship Kane. He's not jumping off that boat at this point.
Harry Kane is a tremendous striker.
Everything he says in the media is always about Harry Kane this, Harry Kane that. He's our most important player. He's our captain.
But he's not their most important player. Like, he's their most important player in theory if he's scoring goals, but he's not scoring goals. He's even when he's dropping back, he's not even doing anything to help them go forward. He's just kind of dropping back to get the ball into a 1-2 pass that's not really progressing the play at all. So it doesn't make sense to me as Harry Kane ship at all.
Well, we'll see what happens in their round of 16 game, which could be against France or a Portugal.
Do you see them beating any of those teams? Because I don't.
No, unless Hungary pulls off an upset and manages to sneak into that third place. They shouldn't have won this game, England. They should have tried to engineer it slightly differently.
But they shot themselves in the foot by not playing well in the Scotland game, because if they lost to Croatia, no, they beat Croatia.
They would have controlled their destiny a little bit.
Yeah, and it's just, they've put themselves in a really bad situation.
I guess you can only top the group and see what happens, but it's
a tough group you're going to be facing.
It is. I guess if you want to go all the way, you've got to beat the best teams. So England might benefit from facing somebody of note before the semi-finals this time around.
You have to win to make the semi-finals, Josh.
Speaking of their semi-final opponents in 2018, Croatia. Ooh. Back with a bang. Tell you how simple this football thing is. Play Nikola Vlasic and suddenly your team looks capable and functional.
Mm. Also helps if you've got a tremendous midfielder by the name of Luka Modric. He's different. He's good. He's one of the best midfielders in the world. So
the Trivella, I think. It's not the Ribona, it's the Trivella off the outside of the boot.
All that I saw was magic. It was pure.
I was up off my couch, like, before he even hit it. You could see it coming a mile away. He loves that. You know who told him not to use the outside of his foot?
Ooh, I'm curious.
Rafa Benitez when he was Real Madrid manager briefly.
Well, briefly is the
and
key word.
And that one bit of advice damaged his reputation so much in the playing group because they all went,
that doesn't make any
this
sense.
This guy looks like a waiter. He has never played at a professional level. Maybe he's a good manager, but he's not going to tell Luka Modric exactly. not to use the outside of his boot.
Key thing, when you go to Real Madrid, you don't tell the players what to do. They tell you what to do. That's how you keep your job.
Exactly. You just got to be like Carlo Ancelotti, smile, raise an exactly. eyebrow and keep Florentino happy.
Exactly.
But Croatia, I just think they've got a Raymond Domenech reincarnation in the dugout. In the sense that a total incompetent is in charge, but they've got such great players on the field
exactly.
and such a generational player, a leader, like Zidane was in 06, in Luka Modric, that can lift them when they have the right selection out there. And the problem for them, and as it was detailed very specifically and in great detail and really well written article on Optusport by our good friend Ante Jukic, who's been thinking all too much about Croatian football over the last few years. And he pointed out the loss of Ivan Rakitic wasn't just solely felt because of his quality and his attributes, but also his positioning, the way he would in that midfield three of Brozovic and Modric at the World Cup, he would position himself very high up the field, very aggressive, the most advanced of the three. And if you can get in behind the midfield line of the opposition off the ball and they can punch a pass through to you, and Brozovic and Modric are very capable of doing that to break the lines, not only does that advance you up the field, it creates this gravitational pull where the midfield of the opposition and the defense collapses in on itself and attracts so many players towards the ball, and that opens up creative opportunities. That's what they were lacking with Kovacic, who's such a great dribbler, but does not move off the ball, does not break the lines with his off-the-ball positioning.
It's like Kovacic wants to swap positions with Modric and wants to make Modric play so far up, but Modric plays a little bit better when he's a little bit deeper because he has control and freedom. And Kovacic is a great player, but not for what this team needs to be great.
He can complement them, but he needs a reference point up front. He's better sort of as a left-sided shuttling midfielder who can dribble out of danger. That's his best attribute, is dribbling, not passing, and certainly not moving.
Dribble for a little bit,
ball.
Pass a simple pass.
Yeah, simple square ball. Like speed a player, open up that bit of space, and then square it off quite quickly. That's what you want Mateo Kovacic to do in your team. That's the only way he's like super effective and not trying passes.
Having
that are
him trying
not
to
useful.
Break down a team is not going to win you.
Problem is, he's always moving towards the ball. He always wants it to his feet, and then he wants to turn, and then he wants to take a player on. And that's...
Did you just do the cheat code for him just then?
It suffocates the possession play if you've got your midfield moving deeper towards the ball all the time. Because Modric wants to do that as well, because he wants to dictate with his passing.
But you can't have three players trying to do that.
And that's where Nikola Vlasic came in this morning. He was playing nominally on the right-hand side of a front three. I know this is getting deep dives on tactics that not everybody enjoys, but bear with me. He was playing nominally in a 4-3-3 on the right, not in his usual number 10 role. Mm-hmm. But if you look at his heat map, he was actually further forward than the striker and right up centrally with him.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So he was basically playing as a striker. And he was making all of these infield runs to overload the opposition, because if he runs infield, it's a bit like the Ninkovic problem when you play Sydney. Does the fullback follow them and then leave a massive gap on the side of the defense? Or do they let them go and let the guy be free and hope the midfield copes with the overload? And that's what Vlasic did so well. And he's just got this prodigious ability to find a gap, show for the ball, and then receive it on the half turn and just go. And it's amazing to watch. He scored a great goal as well. I think that guy, if he keeps starting for Croatia, can lift them much further in this tournament than it originally looked like they were going, and get the big money move that he deserves.
Where do you see them going, Croatia, for this tournament?
It all depends on the coach, the selections. If they play this team again and, you know, they're not too physically jaded, I could see them making a run, honestly, like to the semifinals or beyond.
So they finished, second in the group?
They did finish second.
Who are they facing now? I've forgotten this one.
So there's too many permutations at this point.
Oh, yes, I forget that. Yep, okay.
The third place teams,
yeah,
it's too complicated.
Realized. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I don't have the tournament structure memorized. So, look, it doesn't really matter who they play. They can hang with some of the best teams. It just means that the coach has to select players on ability and on composition. Yeah, well, let Luka coach.
Yeah.
But the coach has to select players based on how they complement each other and not based on seniority and reputation.
That right there is England's problem.
Yeah. It's a problem for a lot of national teams.
Yeah, but for England.
And it's been Croatia's problem for 20 years.
Yeah. I think they've reached a nice sweet spot and they might. I'm with you. I think they have a little bit of a run is going to happen.
Vlasic to Milan is my my early shout.
Everybody's going to Milan. What is this? Nick is going to be very happy. Their Champions League run.
As the replacement for Çalhanoğlu's going across town.
Ooh.
He's signed for Inter, so.
Okay. Well, it's all about AC.
Or maybe back to Everton to prove his old boss wrong.
No, nobody's going to Everton. Let it go, Josh. No one's going there.
Actually, maybe Barcelona. Koeman always rated him in Everton. He played him, and then it was when Koeman moved on that Vlasic got frozen out and went to Russia. So
we'll see.
Anyway, what are the games coming up tonight? Before we go, it's going to be Sweden Poland at 2 a.m., which is a high stakes game. I don't know if it's going to be that entertaining because Sweden are damn boring, and they also only need a draw. That's going to be 11.
West Poland to the bottom.
Poland's bottom of the group. Yep. They need to win. That has a draw written all over it for me.
So we got who else in the group? We've got Spain.
Spain and Slovakia are playing as well.
Slovakia's second at the moment in that group.
Slovakia are second on 3 points. So Spain needs to win this game.
Oh, they definitely do. Who is Spain versus tomorrow?
Slovakia.
Sorry, my brain just short circuit.
Slovakia. We'll put 11 men behind the ball, and it just. It is a matter of whether Spain can put the ball in the net. I think they can. I think they'll go through. I think the hysteria about Spain underperforming is a little bit overblown.
Yeah.
But then again, Morata could miss three sitters again. So,
For so long I wanted him to do well. Like a really, really, because like you could see it. But I just don't think it's going to break for him where he's going to be this magical striker. I think it's over that little period. Mm.
And then it is France, Portugal, and Germany, Hungary at 5 a.m.
Now that's what I'm watching. That's all I'm about.
France Portugal could be a bit of a negative.
It's going to be reckless, is what's going to be.
I think France might rotate.
They've gone. They're going to make it through.
There's talk that they're going to go with a 4-2-3-1 and play Jules Koundé, a centre back, at right back. It's going to be full Deschamps.
Okay.
Anti football. I think it could be disappointing, and I think Germany Hungary could be the sleeper really good game.
Why, you think Hungary are going to beat Germany?
No, I think Germany will win, but I think Hungary are going to come at them. So it's going to look like a contest for a while.
Okay.
And plus there's all the off-field tension with the whole Neuer armband and the Hungarian ultras and not lighting up Allianz Arena. So that's
a whole other
ridiculous, intriguing subplot. But we really don't have time to get into it because we are over time on Twilight Football Procure. Thank you for your company. It's been a delight.
It's been fun, Josh. I liked it.
We will catch you next time. Make sure you stay tuned for tomorrow. For the state of our football nation, because George Danekian and I will be talking to a Sydney FC player.
Ooh.
Who will remain unnamed. But
is that what they call a tease, Josh?
Yeah, I'll give you a little clue. He likes a sausage roll or two.